The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
IPOs are hot, but banks are not. Wondering about a rate cut. And our guest today is Chris Vecchio of the Daily FX. All this and much more on episode number 616 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a great Sunday to you and a happy Father's Day. Yeah, it's happy Father's Day. Father's Day for 2019. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I'm here as the host and a bit of the father on this day as well. But a host of this podcast, The Disciplined Investor, and of course, the co-host of DH Unplugged, where John C. Dvorak and myself get together each and every Tuesday night to talk about just a whole host of things. We talk about some crazy things on that show. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes fun, but a good amount of insight in terms of the financial markets and what is actually shaping the entire environment when it comes to investments. So make sure to tune into that. Make sure you can try to be there for Tuesday nights where we're live and streaming. Just go over to DH Unplugged or just look it up on any of your favorite podcast directories. We'll be there. So to you, I do wish everybody that's listening, I don't care if you're a father or not, happy Father's Day. It is one of those times of the year where we spend a little time reflecting with families, and that's a good thing because it takes us out of the rat race and the whole news cycle. And hopefully you're spending some time with your family and getting some really good quality time in there. Get yourself refreshed a bit. Go the extra mile and tell your father today, you know, you mean a lot to me. You're special. Say something maybe that you're not used to saying. I'm going to do that today. I'm going to be seeing my father for brunch at the club. And I'm going to make sure to make a difference in his life today because I think it's going to make a difference in my life as well. I got to start the show with a bit of an exhalation of frustration into the airways today because I had quite the last couple of days. We're setting up the studio, got a lot of things set up. Actually, I would say 60% set up in the studio. Right now, I'm actually recording in the new studio. We have an audio and a video studio. And that's going pretty well. We have a lot of work to do. And our tech guys are working on the computers and all the lighting and all things. We got a lot of stuff set up, though. Some good backdrops. The setup of this new system is doing pretty well. The screens that we're going to be looking at when we do some shared screen views for the various webinars that we do, et cetera, all that. But when all of a sudden, I noticed something. I brought my laptop that I usually do some of the recording on into the studio, and I'm like, why is the cover not closing? Kind of weird. And as I put it down on the desk, it's kind of wobbling back and forth. It's not level. It's not flat on the desk. And I start looking at it, and I'm realizing, what is going on? There's a bit of a bulge in the keyboard, and there's a bit of a bulge on the back end. So here's what I did. I called Apple support because it seemed to be a swollen battery, kind of warped the entire chassis. So they said, hey, you know what? Go to the store, see what they could do. So I went to the store, and of course I didn't have an absolute appointment at that point. So they said, just wait around. So I waited around for about a half hour, 45 minutes. They said, you know, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get to you today. I said, all right. So they said, come back tomorrow at 1:20 in the afternoon. I said, okay, I'll do that. I can do that. That's fine. So I went back and they said, you know, what you have to do is you have to send this into Apple and they could fix it. It'll cost you $199. I'm like, well, why did I come to the store for that? Why couldn't you just tell me that? Okay. I said, is there anything else I could do? Any other way to do this besides coming back to the store, leaving it for 5 days, you know? They said, well, you can send it to Apple Care. And if you get their number, you can call them. They'll give you all the information. They'll send you a box, ship it to them. 3 to 5 days, they'll have it back to you. I'm like, okay. $199, I'll send it when I'm ready. Okay. So I go back to the office. I call Apple support. Apple support says, yes, we could do that for you. No problem. It'll cost you $100 for labor, $375 for parts, $20 for shipping. I'm like, wait, hold it. Hold it. Wait a minute. That's like, what happened to the $199? You know, now we're talking about double plus the cost. Well, that's what our grid tells us is going to cost you. It's out of warranty, et cetera. I talk with them. I tried things. We talked about things. Finally, they gave in. Finally. And for $199, they're going to fix it. They made a one-time special exception. All right, that's good news. Now, I'm waiting for the box. Probably be here in a couple of days. I'll ship it off. But then just about an hour later after this ordeal on Saturday morning, all of a sudden on my iPhone, the Face ID stopped working on it totally. Like, in other words, it wouldn't recognize my face. I thought maybe there's a smudge. Maybe there's something covering the front camera. I don't know. So I reset it. I tried to re-register the Face ID, and I cleaned the camera, took the case off. Just keeps telling me to move my face up, or actually the iPhone up and down and up and down, but never captured my face. So I'm like, what is going on? So I start a chat support session with Apple. After an hour, they escalated it. I rebooted it. I restarted it. Nothing happened. I took the phone back to factory settings and then restored all. Nope. Nothing. So now I need to go back to the store and go through that whole rigmarole to get this resolved. So that was my... And you know what? I got to tell you. I can't tell you how many years I've been using Apple products. I had the first iPhone when it came out. I had Macs, MacBooks, iMacs, Apple TV. I have never... I can say, honestly, I don't recall ever having any hardware problems with any of the products going back, I don't know, was that 10 years? And all of a sudden, they gang up on me. All of a sudden, it's like, okay. So that's my Apple woes. I don't know if anybody out there has had any of these issues with Apple before in terms of their swollen batteries on their MacBooks or if Face ID stopped working. Do me a favor, if you have and you maybe know what's going on there, and I know what's going on with the battery, so I'll deal with that, but this Face ID thing is really pissing me off because now I can't unlock my phone unless I use a code, which is fine. It's like the old days. But Face ID became so convenient and easy. Just look at it, opens up, and it's done. You can always write me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, either by email that way, or go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a little button on the upper right there that says Ask Andrew. And just send me your notes. Send me what you think. Send me some of the stories you have with Apple. Some of the things that maybe you've uncovered. Was it something I said? Is it because I entered this whole support process that things got a little hairy? I don't know. Is it because all of a sudden, behind the scenes, I'm really switching to Windows for a lot of my stuff that we do in the production? Maybe Apple got a whiff of that. I don't know. But I'll update you when this all gets resolved and tell you what happens. But that was my tale of woes for over the weekend. Switching quickly to the topic of finance, because that's what we do here, right? We talk about finance in the world. It's these IPO actions that we've been seeing recently, this whole incredible move where an IPO is coming to the market at 20 and opening up at 35, finishing the day at 55 or something of that nature. Chewy, the animal product and food and supply company, was the latest company to go public this week after continuing to lose money, which is another thing that we're seeing in many of these IPOs, that they are consistently losing money. It's very reminiscent of the craze that we saw back in the early 2000s, late 1999, 2000, where companies would come to the market without any earnings, without the prospect of being able to actually make money. Now, some of those back then, to be fair, had no revenue either. So this is a different discussion. The whole idea here is that these companies do have revenue. They're looking to ramp it up. And the hope is that one day they'll be extremely profitable when they build it all out. And they do the IPO to bring in money to have some capital expenditures in order to build out the entire process. So that's okay. I got that. Chewy is up 60% for the first day of trading. And this is in line with many of the other similar IPOs that have come, like Beyond Meat. It's interesting. So there's a interesting risk appetite out there. And you have to wonder if that risk appetite that we're seeing right now is something that is more than just, hey, these are great stocks coming to the market. If it is something telling us about where we are in the cycle of investing, where we are actually in this whole euphoria, is it animal spirits that are taking over? Is it something more? And, you know, you're looking at Fiverr, Beyond Meats, Revolve, Chewy. We're coming up on the next week or so with Slack. We have in the future WeWork, Airbnb. Again, none of these are really profitable at this point. As a matter of fact, many of them are losing money in the billions. So clearly we're seeing that this idea of investor interest and I guess the best word is animal spirits are awakened. And is this a continuation of the current state of affairs that we've seen over the last number of years where there's excitement over many of these, like when we saw the GoPros out there come out, or we saw Fitbit, or, you know, those were all personal devices at some time. Now we're starting to see these food companies and also gig economy style of stocks really doing well. But is it a sign of anything more than just it's time for these to come public? Or is it something that there is some concern about, that we're getting towards the end of an extremely long expansionary period, and the euphoria that is surrounding these particular instruments is something that we need to be concerned about? Just a thought. I don't really have an opinion on that right now. I really want to see how this plays out and how, looking down, let's say, a month, 2 months later after these IPOs come out and into their first quarterly earnings, which we recently saw with companies like Zoom and Beyond Meats, did very well with. Of course, we have the Lyft and the Ubers that nobody seemed to want as much as these other deals. But let's just keep an eye on these to see if this is a signal or a sign or something more than just simply companies that have, you know, at the same time decided, hey, this is a really good time to come to market. A couple of important mentions I want to make to you before we get to our guest. Fridays, I host a live trading webinar for Trigger Charts. And we actually do a shared screen webinar where I show you what's actually going on from an economic standpoint, what stocks are moving, a recap of the week, a look into the week ahead. And we do this in about a 30-minute, quick, very fast-paced discussion. You can see all the past ones over at triggercharts.com, also the YouTube channel for Trigger Charts. But we're getting to see some really great interest in this. And I really am very pleased about this. The audience size has been building dramatically in the last few weeks. So you should be there. If you want to understand some of the Trigger Charts indicators, how we use volume at price, modern, a market profile structure for looking at where the lines in the sand are and where the buy signals are, where the sell signals are, where the high volume marks are, all those things we discuss, and a lot more. So you can go over to Trigger Charts, register for the webinars, 9 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time, each Friday. Also, I also want to mention one other quick thing, because a couple of emails and mentions came in about this. So the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy is a strategy that we manage here, and it's kind of a long, short strategy. It's a anything goes. You could see anything about this over on the disciplinedinvestor.com. You could see there is about a 5-minute quick video on the strategy, a very general discussion of the strategy. But I was thinking, and a few people asked me this question, so I thought I would play it back for you here. And where we are right now positioned in this portfolio, I'm really comfortable with. I think it's really good for the current market condition and the exposure that we have, the type of stocks that we have, the hedging that we have on. And again, this is a long, short strategy. So, you know, we're really looking to be somewhat hedged, but also diversified against many of the other investments that you may have out there. But the thing here is, it's, you know, we're possibly entering into this differing phase of the market cycle. And I think this is something that really could work well with your portfolios that you have, whether it's your 401k, whether it's your growth portfolio, whether it's your stock and you're diversified. This adds another layer of diversification, because it is, again, long, short. It's a hedge. There's some hedging in there, et cetera. So in down cycles, hopefully what's going to be, or the strategy is geared to, is to have a limitation on and a bit of a lessening blow of some of the downside. And of course, the upside is, you know, at the same time, could be cap because of some of the hedging as well. But generally speaking, it gives you a much different level of diversification in your portfolio. So what I'm going to be doing is setting up personal calls with anyone who wants more information on this. You know how to contact me. You can go check out the quick video we put together on the disciplinedinvestor.com. Look up the TDI Managed Growth Strategy and just click on that. And then I'll be there if you want more information to set up a little quick chat and discuss it and maybe look at your personal situation. So talk directly to me, and I'll be doing this for the next few weeks just to make sure that everybody that is interested can get a hold of me and actually do it. So just put in the note there that you want to talk with Andrew or anybody that does put in a quick contact form with that. I will make sure to reach out to and schedule something. All right. With that, I think we have a great guest today. And I want to talk about a lot of the things that are going on in the currency markets because that's where his expertise lies. So let's get right to that interview. And our guest today is Chris Vecchio. He's a CFA and a senior currency strategist for the Daily FX, a commodities and FX research site owned by the IG Group. So he knows a lot about this area of commodities as well as currencies. And that's good because we're seeing a lot of, well, let's just say action in that market of late. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing very well today. How are you, Andrew?
Good. I know you're up in New York. I know that you saw some crazy rain the last few weeks. You had that big helicopter scare. What, last week or this week, I guess it was, right?
Oh, yeah, earlier this week, terrible.
Yeah, anytime you hear that there's a some kind of a crash of some kind of anything into a building in Manhattan, people start freaking out, rightfully so, of course. I mean, you know, just brings back very bad memories.
Oh, I can tell you that's so, where my own memory went. My parents were both downtown on 9/11 walking into the South Tower, so that was a day for me that I'll always remember.
Wow, that's kind of spooky.
Yeah, so that was a hell of a day.
So you've been you've lived in the U.S., you've lived in the U.K., you lived in France, you've been all over the place, and I guess that you spent a lot of time, obviously, dealing with macroeconomics and all that. So I thought we would go over first of all, because we don't talk about currencies that much on this show, but I thought we would talk about is the basic tenets of currencies and currency trading and how. Maybe there's been a change over the years in the action of it. So kind of give us a quick glance into what currency trading is all about and kind of what are the tools that you use to make your decisions?
Sure. So the currency market is fundamentally different than other markets like stocks or bonds. Whereas stocks and bond markets are open for a set period of time during the day, currency markets are actually open 24 hours once markets open up on Sunday. They're open from Sunday 5 p.m. in New York until Friday 5 p.m. In New York. It's actually the most liquid market in the world as well, whereas you have roughly $200 billion worth of value change hands in equity markets around the world every single day. You have about $5.2 trillion worth of exchange volume going through currency markets. So this is a monster, a beast unto itself with very significant capital flows. But like what I said before, stocks and bonds are different than currency insofar as when you're buying a currency, you're not buying a claim to a specific asset. You're buying a currency in relation to another currency. So if I buy the euro, really that's shorthand for saying I'm buying the euro versus the US dollar. If I'm buying Apple stock, I'm just buying Apple stock. I'm not buying Apple versus, say, Dell. I'm not doing a spread trade, if you will, on that. Currency is unique as well insofar as when we think about how these positions are taken, traders end up using a lot more leverage when trading currency than they do stocks or bonds. In the United States, you can get up to 50-1 leverage on a position that you take in the currency market, whereas with ETFs, you can sometimes, get like the triple levered S&P 500 ETF. But that means for traders, if you're going to be operating in currency markets, you kind of have to think of it like how you would operate in futures markets for commodities. You have a lot of leverage. You have margin to deal with. You need to make sure that you're not taking on too much risk. Otherwise, you can blow yourself out in just one trade. So it's a different beast all to itself. And I think that for people who aren't familiar with the currency market or commodities markets, you'd find that it has a lot greater effect on your life than you would believe once you get into the weeds.
Well, it's also because, for a long time, it was like, okay, I don't want to trade currencies because they trade pretty much 24 hours, a couple of little bitty areas over the weekend where there's a little bit of rest. But then the whole weekend, you're worrying about something like blowing up or somebody coming out with a statement or some country deciding to devalue or who knows what. But then in walks the door, cryptocurrencies, which trade 24/7, no break. So that's even more of an intense, you know, it makes currency trading look, I don't want to say calm, but it is a little bit, right? It does take a little bit of the excitement away of comparatively. But the thing that about currency trading that's always been on my mind when I talk with anybody that trades currencies is, how do you deal with the fact that as a currency trader, you're not only trading against other traders, you're trading against governments, which have an unlimited pocketbook to do whatever they want to do. How do you work with that?
Right, and that's a very good point. You're dealing with some players in this marketplace, very much like trading in the oil market, where there are institutional operators that are far bigger than, say, you know, a pension fund that's trying to allocate for their employees. Even if you're looking at something like CalPERS, the California State Pension System, its activity is dwarfed significantly by several magnitudes of what, say, the U.S. Treasury is doing to manage open market operations, or the Federal Reserve is doing, or the Swiss National Bank or BOJ or any number of other treasuries, a number of countries or their central banks. So as a trader, how do you take advantage of this type of activity? Well, in markets, generally speaking, there are really two ways you can do so. You can try to trade event risk, where you're hoping that economic information comes out different than what the market has anticipated, and therefore you have a mispricing opportunity. That's always fun to see in real time, actually. You have the impact of price discovery unfolding before your very eyes. For example, yesterday's inflation data comes out. The U.S. dollar initially trades lower and whips around, and there's a direct reflection of how the market feels that the Fed will move on rates over the course of the next year. And of course, then that means there are central bankers in other countries saying, okay, well, if inflation down in the United States is moving in this regard, then we feel that we're going to need to hedge our foreign exchange exposure in such and such manner. And so we're going to have to allocate, you know, new positions to U.S. dollar long or shorts. I think that it's difficult, very difficult to have an edge if you're operating in an environment where you're only trading on public information in the currency market. Because again, all that information.
Hold it. What other information is there?
Well, see, this is where you have the rub on the currency market. Currency markets operate in a manner where you can see prices reflect information a lot quicker than it is otherwise revealed in, say, stocks and bonds. What I mean by that is when information comes out from stocks and bonds, it typically has to go through an official channel, like through the SEC. It has to be cleared through an official financial statement or release. Whereas with currency markets, a lot of this is operating on rumors and political whims. You have the influence of politics in currency markets a lot more than you do in stocks or bonds, because what President Trump tweets out can be something that moves the euro and the pound and the yen and the Chinese yuan all at once. Whereas something that's specific to Apple, yes, that may cause a gyration in the headline Dow, but unless that can be substantiated with a real, say, supply chain concern, it's only unlikely that that concern will reverberate through the rest of the public market. So rumors and misinformation have the tendency and ability to drive fluctuations in currency markets, I feel, a lot more effectively than it can in the broader stock market or in bond markets. That would be a lot more company-specific risk that needs a lot more justification or substantiation in order to have a sustainable material impact on price action.
So I asked the obvious question, or at least my obvious question, is why would you trade that? Why would you get involved in such a situation where you can have rumors that are either substantiated or unsubstantiated? You can have governments that are working against you. You can have simple tweets really throwing things out of whack. And, you know, working in an environment that not only trades on realistic information, but also unknowns and, of course, let's just say misinformation.
So a lot of people like trading the currency markets, particularly in the low rate era, because of the lack of volatility that we've seen in stocks and bonds. Given the amount of leverage that people can use when trading currency, there's an appeal there where, okay, if I'm in a low volatility situation, I can pack a little bit more punch into this trade. And so even though the markets aren't going to move, I can still reach my goals of achieving certain account growth during this period of time. If I'm trying to say, okay, my goal this year is to grow my book by, you know, 8% risk-adjusted return. You know, I can do that more effectively in an environment where prices are moving, as opposed to just sitting in a buy and hold environment with stocks. There's also the idea that in FX markets, it's a lot harder to manipulate as an individual player. You're never going to have a Hunt Brothers situation like you did in the silver market, where the Hunt Brothers drove up the cost of silver to about $50 an ounce before the government had to step in. The market's so deep and liquid that it's impossible for even one government to take the type of position where it has a permanent impact on driving prices. Central bank intervention never has a permanent impact either. It's typically something that fades in the span of a matter of a few days or a week. Nothing to me stands out more than that than what happened with the central bank intervention around the Fukushima earthquakes in 2011, when the Japanese yen weakened quite significantly over the span of a few weeks, only to reverse said losses as the intervention was unwound, as traders adjusted for it in their books.
Let's talk about Japan. Do you trade the yen?
I do, yes.
So it seems to me that for the last, I don't know, forever, that the trade on the yen has always been to short the yen. I mean, there have been times, don't get me wrong, there's been times that the yen in a, which I also find very bizarre, by the way, that a safety trade is to go long the yen, right? That's what it was for a long time, where you'd have, you know, markets were freaking out, things were going crazy, and the yen was being bought. And that hasn't happened recently as much as it did for a long time. But the Japanese government is, I guess, absolute in their desire to keep that yen lower. That's a big issue because they have such a big export economy that they always have their finger on the button. If you look at the opening of trading at 8 p.m. in the evening, when it kind of kicks back up and when you see that, you know, Japan's starting to open, it's almost invariably every single day the yen gets sold as soon as that opens up. You notice that, right?
I have. And I think that the market is actually at a point of reckoning with how it views Japan's public debt burden. You know, over the last several decades, you've seen Japan's public debt burden grow. And in fact, it has the highest debt to GDP ratio of any developed country in the world, more than Greece, even, from roughly sitting around 240% of GDP. Now, for a lot of years, this has been known as like the widowmaker trade. You don't short Japanese government bonds, even though on paper, this is an economy where, because of how high the debt to GDP ratio is, these bonds should lose a lot of value very quickly. But it's been called the widowmaker for a reason. People keep going to this trade, trying to short the yen, trying to short JGBs, and they keep getting slaughtered. So I think there's a framework in which you need to view how Japan's debt is currently held, right? Japan's debt, around 92% of it, is held domestically by consumers, by businesses, pension funds, by the government itself. And so, whereas for an economy like Greece, where much of its debt is held externally by foreign creditors in Germany, in the UK, in Italy, in the United States, Japan's biggest creditor is itself. So in the event that it would default on its debt, it would be defaulting on itself and would have to recapitalize itself. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. I think then when you view it through the paradigm of, and this is going to sound wacky itself because I haven't fully come around to embracing this idea and I don't know if I ever will, but if you view the world through the MMT mindset, the modern monetary theory mindset.
Oh, don't say that.
And I don't want to, but if you think about it that way, if you think about it that way, then a country who prints its own money and is the only buyer of its own debt, why would they default on it ever, right? You'd be shooting yourself in the foot. So Japan's debt holders have no incentive to default on their own debt because they would be the ones who are defaulting. It's kind of like with the Greece issue a few years ago with their default scenario. The ISDA is the board of banks that determine whether or not a default event has occurred. the banks themselves would have been the biggest losers had the default event occurred. So they made the decision not to declare it a default event, right? When the referees are the people who are playing the game,
yeah,
they can make up the rules as they play. And essentially that's what's going on here, which is ridiculous. It's not really a principle that if you can change it on whim to fit the needs of your immediate short-term interests.
So here's how I see it. Let me tell you how I see it. Let me tell you the graphical view of how Andrew Horowitz sees the Japan buying of their own debt and using, you know, this MMT concept to continue, extending this whole process. It's essentially cannibalism. Mm-hmm. However, in cannibalism, you eat other people. But I'm saying, let's do it auto-cannibalism. You're eating yourself. Now you say, well, Andrew, okay, but there's only so far you can go with that, right? Yeah, but what they're doing is they're also eating their own feces. So what's happening is, you know, basically they're what you would think would be a certain time period where, okay, I don't have any arms left. I don't have any legs left. All right. I'm eating my torso, to a point that, you know, all right, I'm cutting off all sorts of areas and that's it. No, they've extended it because they basically have a pile of excrement that they're also eating, extending it. But I think there is eventually a natural end, as would be in my scenario, to the Japanese ability to continue buying their own debt because they're reaching capacity. What did they do when they started reaching capacity? Recently, they started buying ETFs in their own market, right?
Right.
They own something like 70% of the publicly traded ETFs in the market of the Japanese stock exchange. They own. Where else can they go? I mean, they're going to start buying maybe the next thing. They'll buy their own real estate. I don't know. You know, I mean, what's next? But this can't go on forever, can it? Now, I won't trade it either because I know it's a widowmaker trade, but it just can't go on. When, I don't know, listen, you don't know either because you just told me that, but, you know, when will there be a reckoning? But when there is, it's going to be ugly. Would we agree to that?
When there's a reckoning, it's going to be ugly. The problem is timing this. I mean, how can a country resolve a very large public debt burden, right? You can grow out of it, you can repay it, you can default in it, or if you get lucky enough, you can inflate your way out of it. For Japan, a country with an old aging population with a large deal of their money tied up in domestic savings, inflation would be political suicide. You would literally end your own political prospects if you tell people, hey, I know you've worked your entire life to build up your money for retirement, but we're about to destroy its value so we can pull ourselves out of our debt burden. That's not going to happen. We know Japan's not going to grow.
Well, they did start to do that with negative interest rates.
They tried.
Well, they're trying.
Is it successful? Empirically, I don't think it is.
Look at Europe back almost. It's a disaster. Europe's back into potential recession. You have negative interest rates there. That's the only reason there's a bid to our bonds over here. Our deficit growth is out of control. Our public debt is out of control. Our pricing on our bonds shouldn't be where they are. It's only a relative trade, in my opinion. Where else are you going to go? You're going to go to Japan? You're going to go to Norway? You're going to go to Europe? You're going to go to Italy? You're going to go to Germany? You're going to get negative rates. I mean, that's
exactly.
Who's buying that?
Right. And if you're an asset manager right now, you have to take into account your, you know, FX adjusted return for holding foreign debt. And, up until recently, there wasn't a reason why you would want to hold those debts above the U.S. Treasury. I mean, in November, U.S. Treasury 10-year was up around 3.2%. All right. I know we're off about 100 basis points now, but up until only very recently, has it somewhat become more appealing to reconsider holding other countries' debt when you take into account the exchange rate? And for Japan, right? Yes, this is a big problem, but how do we get there, right? Are they going to grow their way out of this? No. Can they repay their way out of this? No. Are they going to default? Well, we talked about default. That'd be self-deprecating. They're not going to do that. And we know they're not going to inflate their way out because no politician wants to lose their job. That's the number one goal of a politician, right? Hold on to power. So an end will come sometime. I don't know how it ends because I don't see any off-ramp right now. So to me, this seems like the widowmaker is going to stick around for a very long time. And I just wouldn't try to touch
them. The problem is going to become if other countries, which they have already, well knowing that it doesn't work, it just sustains, it doesn't create any growth, other countries entering into the same game. That's where the problems come in. But, you know, one of the things that's unusual is that there's been a lot of relationships that have been broken over the years. And one of the relationships that's really interesting is that for some time, they go back a bit in time, there was this concept that, you know, dollar down, oil up, dollar down, gold up, or vice versa. You know, commodities would move higher as the dollar moved lower. And then it sort of broke. It was kind of no rhyme or reason over the last couple of years for this. You know, maybe it's because of the cryptocurrencies, everybody's buying that. They prefer that over, you know, that as an alternative diversifier in a portfolio. But recently we've seen both gold and the US dollar moving in tandem. Now, there's been some talk about, now let me think about this. It was China just this week. There's some talk about China stockpiling. And of course, we know about the India period of time and during the year where there's that seasonality where there's they buy a lot of gold and all that. But what's going on with this whole, you know, gold trade? Gold starting to move up about, what, 1340, 1335, 1340. Yet the dollar is sustaining a much higher level. Why is that broken?
I think this speaks to the nature of the safe haven bit of the market right now. If we go back to 2011, really, after we've gotten through the U.S. downgrade in August 2011, after we make our way through the, we'll call it the worst of the Eurozone debt crisis in the fall that year, central banks really kick everything into high gear. Governments around the world begin to relax their balance sheets after the Great Recession, and we see a lot of stimulus being pumped into the market. And so no longer were traders incentivized to hold on to gold as the safe haven of last resort, because at the end of the day, it didn't look like we were going to go into a period where there was a complete sovereign meltdown. To me, gold is a safe haven for sovereign incompetence, right? When the world looks like it's going to end and fiat currency may not be worth what it's worth, that's when you want to bury your gold and hold on to it. But once central banks stepped in, once we had that whatever it takes attitude come in from Mario Draghi and those other central bankers in that 2011, 2012 period, then all of a sudden it didn't look like the world was going to come to an end. The planet may have been on fire, but it was manageable, at least. And so gold's erosion began on this slow trajectory. Last year in August, that all started to change. And I think that's largely due to what you mentioned, these geopolitical concerns surrounding China. I know that we have the seasonality to do with India and a lot of gold buying for some of the religious holidays there. But the perhaps the most important driving factor for gold right now, more than one country, more than anything else, has been the fact that we are going into a period again where there appears to be sovereign incompetence in play.
Oh, really?
Right?
It's like freaking amateur hour out there. It's amateur hour.
It's worse than that. And I have a lot of thoughts on this issue, but I know there's children listening at home, so we'll keep it PG-13. But with this period that we're entering into in the world where we have actors who, you know, see the way certain countries are behaving and they are getting away with it. If it's a situation like Japan where we say, okay, well, this country is not managing its debt burden. It's running up deficits. Its unemployment rate's low. It doesn't have these domestic woes, these socioeconomic woes that are plaguing a country like the United States or the UK or France, where you have high rates of youth unemployment, where you have growing debt burdens, you have unproductive uses of government spending. Why not do it like that? Maybe it will work. And sure, it could work for a short period of time, but we know that on a long-term basis, a country can't run a scheme like that, a system of governance like that forever. And the house of cards comes crashing down. So I do think that gold's appeal right now is rising because geopolitical uncertainty is back in vogue. To me right now, there's nothing more important for gold prices than watching what happens on the US-China trade war front. And to that end, I think that the 7 level in dollar yuan, the exchange rate, is perhaps the most important level in all financial instruments right now. It doesn't matter if it's US Treasuries, the S&P 500, dollar yuan 7, that's the place you got to look.
You're talking about a weakening of the yuan.
I'm talking about a weakening of the yuan. China has shown the desire to use a weaker yuan as a way to offset the impact of the Trump tariffs. We know this because of the way that the IMF has measured the fiscal multiplier for the Chinese yuan with respect to their exports. If, based on the IMF's assumption, the elasticity of demand in context of the exchange rate is roughly 1, and so a 10% depreciation in the yuan would roughly increase exports by 1.5% of Chinese GDP. And so for an economy that's $11 trillion, That means you're talking about roughly $150 to $200 billion in additional goods purchased by foreigners in the event of a 10% depreciation of the yuan. And guess what? If you get $150 or $200 billion of additional economic activity in China, that offsets the Trump tariffs.
Right.
And so
even if there's not any additional activity, the drop in the currency is a significant offensive or defense, depending on how you want to look at this, but it's a significant combat move, because what you have there is that it basically, for China, it offsets the tariffs because their stuff is much cheaper. So therefore, let's just for a moment say that it drops the price to an equilibrium on the 10% tariff. Let's just say that for a second.
Sure.
And then in addition to that, it prohibits, in a way, China from buying the goods of countries outside the U.S. because their currency has depreciated, and they put tariffs in, reciprocal tariffs on many items as well. Therefore, it's a win for China. Now, my opinion on this, you and I haven't talked before about this, but my opinion on this is this. There's two things going on here. Obviously, there's a desire for the U.S. to get a better deal when it comes to working with China on fairness of trade. I got that. More importantly is the IP protection, them stealing our goods, stealing our intellectual property. I understand that too. But there's a variable in here that I don't think has been discussed enough, and that is that, first of all, China sees the long game. They're in it for the long haul. How long have they been around? Thousands of years. We're here for, what, 250 years, the U.S., right?
Yeah.
So, or thereabouts. So the other thing that's interesting is that our president right now, as we sit here right this moment, has what, another year and a half left. Now, he could get reelected, but he's got to prove himself into that election. In China, they changed the constitution, and their president is now in a lifetime position. He cannot lose political points. So I think they're really willing to wait. This isn't talked about. No, I mean, really, I haven't heard anybody besides myself constantly talking about this. But, and then, so you have this long game situation. And there's one thing that's also important here. Have you been to China?
I have not had the pleasure of going there. No, not yet.
I've been there several times. And I'll tell you something very important about China. They have been conquered many times in history. They have the opinion that they will never be conquered again. And this economic attempt to conquer them doesn't sit well with them. You don't go at them full-throated. You don't go at them you have to go at them in a soft sell. Now, people are listening like, China's been ripping us off for years. Let me tell you something, folks. We've been getting a good deal from China as well for years. You like your computers at these prices? Well, that's because it's being made by cheap labor. You like the shirts and the cars, and you like all the things that you're doing in life? That's because a lot of it's a lot cheaper because we outsource that. The prices would be prohibitively expensive if we didn't do so. So there is some benefit to both sides. This isn't just one-sided. And don't forget, we built this monster. We're the ones that were offshoring. We're the ones that built the initial factories and wanted cheaper goods. So, you know, we have to clean up our own mess in this circumstance. And I do agree, of course, it's not just one-sided for China. But the thing is that when it comes to China, you can't just go at them. Their culture is not, you know, you can't punch them in the face and just hopefully turn around and say, okay, we agree. Your comments on that tirade? Any thoughts?
I'm honestly with you 100%. We haven't spoken about this before yet, but I think actually the points that you bring up are very valid. I find myself as one of those people who views the world through a little bit more of a political lens. My background is not just finance, but also in politics as well. And I see that China's timeline for their leadership is more than the next year and a half or potentially 5.5 years. Best case scenario for Trump, he's in office for one more term. He's through 2024 and that's it. But Xi Jinping will still be president of China at that time. He can't afford to weaken his ruling mandate by taking a short-term loss that effectively gives the president of the United States, the country's chief economic and military rival, the ability to gain more political power and popularity. So I don't see how China, from their point of view, is incentivized to cave in. Trump is very incentivized to use as much pressure as he can on China because he wants to show that, yes, he deserves another chance for another 4 years in office. But I do think that there is kind of a rock meets a hard place here. If Trump levies enough pressure against China in the short term because of how much manufacturing activity takes place there, it will have a real negative impact on the economy insofar as it could push up unemployment. And this is a country where you have a large agrarian working class, which is slowly transitioning into a consumer class. It's a country where a lot of the goods that they themselves consume are produced at home. And so when we decide to stop buying things from them and factories shut down, it pushes up price pressures, it brings down employment, it creates a lot of social ills for them. And I think that's part of the plan here for the Trump administration, try to make this as painful as possible to force concessions before social ailments arise.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, to that end, as you pointed out here, when we talk about dealing with China on this front, China does have bargaining chips at the table. Like you mentioned, this hasn't just been a vacuous, leech parasitic relationship where China's just been taking all the jobs out of the country and that's that. Americans, particularly Americans in urban areas, enjoy depressed costs of goods than they otherwise would enjoy because of the fact that we have artificially cheap labor being used to produce the goods that we consume. That's why tariffs are effectively a tax on American consumers. If it costs
us— No. No, I've been told the tariff is paid by the contra country. What are you talking about?
No, see, that's just nonsense. The tariff is paid by— If I'm buying a good from China as a consumer, that good gets shipped to America by that company, and then I have to pay the additional fee to the U.S. government at the border for me to bring it in. So the incentive there is then say, okay, I don't want to buy Chinese goods then because I don't want to have to pay that additional fee. I'm going to buy that good from Vietnam or Taiwan. I'm going to pay a substitute a little bit less money for the same quality of a product. It's not going to go to China. And so that's where China steps in and uses the yuan as a tool to offset the impact of the tariff. If they weaken their exchange rate enough, then the U.S. consumer won't see that tax at them. They'll say, okay, well, you know, I have to pay the tariff, but the exchange rate is so much better in my favor. It's a wash. I'm not paying anything more for my Chinese imported goods.
You know, I just thought of something. Something has been bothering me this whole discussion, not today, but in general, where President Trump has been saying, hey, China's going to pay for the, you know, China pays the tariffs. You know, I think he must use the word differently. You know, how he would say to, hey, dude, you're going to pay, buddy. You wronged me. You are going to pay. Concept versus dollar, right? You follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah, and this is the whole, you know, you take him literally, you take him figuratively type of argument. And I think that because I've seen President Trump as Donald Trump, real estate developer in New York tabloids my entire life, having grown up in the New York area. He's a guy who talks like a New Yorker. Period. He's loudmouthed. He talks in euphemisms. He tells big stories. He weaves big tales. And so you don't take someone like that literally. You don't split hairs over every single word they use. So maybe he's saying China's going to pay for it, as in like they, the general country China, will suffer because we're not going to be buying their goods, and therefore they're maybe he's talking in that type of term. But like then you have economists and people like myself who have studied this for our lives and say, okay, well, technically, when we talk about tariff and who's paying for it, it's actually me, the consumer, who's paying for it. Yes, Chinese people are going to have fewer jobs because we're going to be buying less of their goods. But at the end of the day, if I still want to buy my Chinese widget from, you know, Chinese company XYZ, to do so now, it's going to cost me 25% more.
Yeah. So tell me something. Let's go back to the FOMC decision that's on tap for next week, that there is a give or take a 33% chance of a rate cut, which I think is idiotic. from all that I can see, yes, things are getting a little bit rougher in terms of manufacturing. We're seeing a little bit of slowdown, maybe a one-off due to weather and some other issues with employment. We're seeing that consumer sentiment still holding okay. Retail sales, nothing exciting there. Some front loading clearly being done in the inventory builds and all, but this 33% chance is, I think, morphing itself into, oh, yeah, the Fed's got our back and they're going to do something. How are you, because I know you're going to play this in the currency market, how are you setting up for this trade?
I'm with you there as well. It feels like people are saying, okay, you know, the Fed's got our back. The world's fine. There's no downside from here. The party's going to continue rolling on. I don't think that the Fed does anything next week. It is a week in which they will produce a new summary of economic projections, and therefore they're going to be moving their GDP, inflation, and employment forecasts. To that end, the previous iteration in March detailed the possibility for one more rate hike in 2020 before the end of their cycle. Now, after last week's commentary by Fed Chair Powell, in which he said that they were monitoring the situation closely and they would act appropriately if trade tensions spilled over, there is a sense of belief that the Fed will indeed announce that its rate hike cycle is officially over and they will look to potentially cut rates later on this year. But the fact of the matter is right now, the economy hasn't rolled over just yet. And therefore, the Fed isn't going to be quick to pull the trigger just because financial markets are getting itchy. The unemployment rate is still at the cycle low near 3.4% now, 3.6%. We see that the headline CPI is right at 1.9%, just around the Fed's medium-term target of 2%. Those are the two big mandates that the Fed has, labor market and price stability. Right now, according to the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now Tracking Index, Q2 19 U.S. growth is at 1.4% annualized. That is lower than the 3.2% annualized that we saw for the first quarter. But again, that's nothing that's going to get the Fed too worked up about needing to cut rates immediately. I think the fact that the Mexico tariffs are also being avoided is a big reason why the Fed won't be looking to act immediately either. Studies were showing that if you had the aggregate impact of the China tariffs, the Mexico tariffs, and the auto tariffs globally in place all at once, the U.S. economy would grow by 1.2% slower this year than it otherwise would have. So now that the global auto tariffs are not necessarily going to be there because of the Mexico tariffs not being in place, the direct immediate impact on the U.S. economy is going to be a lot lower. It could perhaps be half as much, maybe only 0.3, 0.4%. And therefore, the impetus for the Fed to act as soon as June is going to be a lot more reduced. That said, Fed funds futures right now are very negative. They are pricing in at least two cuts this year. There's an 84% chance of two rate cuts by the end of this year. And according to Eurodollar contracts, which are three-month, $1 million notional contracts between commercial banks, effectively to set interest rates between banks, those Eurodollar contracts are pricing out three rate cuts between now and the next 12 months by June 2020. So this is a rate decision next week where the Fed going into it is telling us that they want to raise rates once more next year. The market's telling us that we have three rate cuts coming by this time next year. So the Fed looks like they're going to be changing their tune. The question is just how much they buy into this notion that they will be getting very dovish very, very quickly.
All right. Translation. Dollar down?
I don't think so. I think this idea.
You don't think so?
No, I think that much of the negativity about the Federal Reserve acting on moving on rates immediately is going to be considered overblown. Again, there's a 95% chance right now that the Fed cuts rates by September. How much more can that get priced in, right? I don't think there's a lot
agree,
of.
I would agree, but don't you think also? But don't you think that the dollar? Well, I guess the point is we're the cleanest shirt in the closet at this point. You know, our stuff is looking much better than Europe. It's looking better than the potential. Well, China's still good, but looking better than their direction. Japan, yuck.
We're still going to have higher interest rates. We're still going to have higher interest rates than a lot of other developed economies around the world. That's the RBA, the RBNZ, BOE, ECB. I mean, just like you said, we're the cleanest shirt in a dirty laundry right now, best house in a bad neighborhood. Would you want to invest in the pound with everything going around Brexit or the ECB, the euro and the ECB, given that Mario Draghi's leaving and Italy's a problem and France is a problem or Japan and their giant debt burden? I mean, the United States has its own issues, but it's not like anywhere else is, you know, the shining city on the hill that everyone aspires to be.
I wonder if the next round of central bankers is going to be the same jolly, give it all away kind of group, you know, where we had Yellen, Bernanke to a degree, Yellen, Kuroda, and Draghi, which were like, hello, you know, let's just, they were just jolly. And would you like to just be on a fly on the wall in one of their meetings one day?
Absolutely. And actually, one of my favorite things to look at is these transcripts that the Fed releases from, you know, the meetings are around the financial crisis. They typically have, like, I think, a 7-year lag time when they release the actual conversations that were held in the board meeting minutes. And you could just see how some of these policymakers are so smug and unprepared for the damage and the turmoil that was about to be laid before them. I think a lot of the mindset that the policymakers had in recent years was informed by what had happened with the Latin American crisis and the long-term capital management crisis in the 1990s. Tim Geithner in his memoirs talked about the impact of dealing with what happened with the Asian tigers and the fallout from long-term capital management in the 90s. And he realized that the only way that you can effectively save an economy is by providing a crazy amount of support up front, being very heavy-handed over the top, kind of redoing the scene that you have in It's a Wonderful Life, where the bankers are literally putting stacks of money up in the window to show window dressing. Yeah. Economies sometimes need that, because in situations where interest rates rise on the short end of the curve too quickly, those companies that are solvent get washed out with those companies that are illiquid. And that's the problem that you have. So because economies are not sandboxes that you can just, you know, build sandcastles and have experiments and knock them down and rebuild them at a whim without any cost for anyone, I think central bankers were of the belief that we need to go over the top and overshoot and risk overshooting rather than risk undershooting. Because if you undershoot, you have a situation where aggregate demand underperforms for such a period of time where you can go into depression-like conditions. And this is why people are a lot more afraid of deflation than inflation, right? When you put down money for a home, for example, you don't put down 100% cash for your mortgage, right? You'd like to put down 20%, but in America, people typically put down 5%. So if the housing market falls by 5%, you've just wiped out people's home equity right off the bat. Central bankers are a lot more afraid of deflation than they are of inflation. There's a lot more upside to it.
What's really fascinating about all this, this whole experiment, what's really fascinating about all this is that with all the incredible amount of upfront money, with the continuation of emergency-like economic policies and low interest rates and negative interest rates and quantitative easing and buying it, we can't move the needle on inflation. Can you imagine if they didn't do this?
Makes you wonder if the way that policymakers are deploying capital in the most productive ways possible, right?
Well, that, I mean, it doesn't make me wonder. It's no. The answer is no. It doesn't make me wonder at all.
I don't wonder either. I'm just saying it out there for the listener who may not have considered this. But as someone who's in the industry, you can see like when good money chases after bad, what happens? Well, you don't get a return on your capital. And so if we're pouring money into the economy in these regards and we're not generating any inflation, then effectively what it means is that people are just taking this money and they're putting it in their pocket. And that was the big quip about QE and all these programs during the financial crisis, which was banks are taking money from the Fed at ultra low rates. They're then basically reinvesting in treasuries and they're pocketing the interest rate differential difference, which was a great deal at the time if you wanted to rebuild your balance sheet. I would have loved to have done that for several years. You let me borrow at 0%, invest at 3%, and I get to pocket the difference. It's free money. It's great for my clients' returns.
So tell me where people can get information. I know you have some things that you put out. You have your daily FX trading guides you put out. Where can people go and get more information?
So there are several ways to interact with me personally if you want to continue this conversation or others. I maintain a fairly hefty social media presence through StockTwits and Twitter. That's at CVecchioFX, CVECCHIOFX. You can also follow me on dailyfx.com where we publish our research ideas for our brokerage, which is IG.com.
IG.com. Very good. All right, Chris Vecchio, I appreciate you spending some time. A very fascinating discussion. Covered a lot of stuff. It seems that we have very similar ideas on a lot of this, on a lot of these topics, but it was good to flush them out, and I appreciate that.
Andrew, it was a pleasure talking with you. Hopefully, talk to you soon.
All right. Great. Thanks so much. See you later. Bye-bye. That's going to be a wrap of this episode. Some great information distilled from Chris Vecchio over at the Daily FX. And the site is pretty cool. You really should check that out. If you have any questions, again, just go over to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Make sure to tell your friends, your family, tell your father something great today. And of course, tell them, hey, I was listening to The Disciplined Investor today. What a great podcast. You should listen to. Spread the word. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for being here this week. Thanks so much for being here each and every week. And as we could tell, like I said, our audience is growing on a regular basis. There's obviously something going right here, and I'm really proud of that. So thank you so much for all the things you've done for me. Have a happy Father's Day, a great weekend, and I'll see you next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.